Okay, so we are approaching the last couple of lectures on synchronization, and then we'll start talking about memory management. Okay, so this is a quick recap of what we were talking about last time. We spent some time talking about the reader-writer problem. In this problem, you have a shared data structure that threads are trying to access. Okay. And the typical way to protect access to any shared data structure is put a lock around those accesses. Whenever you access, you do an acquire before you access that data structure, and after you are done, do a release. Okay? We said that may be too restrictive in a scenario where you can take the threads and partition them into two categories, readers and writers. Okay? Readers are threads that only read the data structure but never modified, and writers modify. Okay, so we said if you have these two categories of threads, then you can allow multiple readers to access at the same time. You don't need to have a mutually exclusive lock on the data structures, but writers do need to have a mutually exclusive lock. So we saw how to address that problem, and then towards the end I said what those concepts also illustrate is how read-write locks are actually implemented. So if you have this problem, typically you won't do what we said last time. You will just use a new abstraction. You won't use a standard lock. You will use a special type of a lock called a read-write lock. But the exercise illustrated how those locks are implemented. How do you ensure multiple readers can read and only a single writer writes? Okay. So as I said, in practice you use read-write locks. And the last slide of the class was on this dining philosopher's problem, which I'm going to reintroduce, and then we'll try to solve that problem. Okay. So as I said, in this problem we assume that there are n philosophers sitting around a table. In this case you have 5 of them. Okay, and the philosophers essentially only do one of two things. They either think or they become hungry and they want to eat. Okay, so when they are thinking, they are not eating, and when obviously they are eating, they can't think, they are too hungry. Okay, so this is the setup, that before you eat, you have to grab 2 forks. Okay, there's a bowl of spaghetti, so you need 2 forks to eat. There's a left fork and a right fork, and in this case, the forks are shared between neighbors. Okay, just to illustrate, so the forks are your shared resource, and a resource in this case is always shared with your left and right neighbor. Okay, and the synchronization problem is one where if you want to eat, you will eventually be able to grab both your left fork and right fork, so you won't starve, physically starve in this case. Okay. If you basically try to grab a fork, eventually you will get one. Okay, so you don't want a scenario where you starve because you don't get your fork, and even once you are hungry, you want to get it within a limited period of time. Okay, so that's really the dining philosopher's problem. Here is a sample, not a sample, rather a suggested solution, and then we'll ask what goes wrong if you do it this way. Okay, so this is a very simple solution where every fork has a semaphore associated with it. Okay, it's almost like a lock. Think of it as a lock on that fork. So what each philosopher does is says, grab a lock on my left fork, grab a lock on my right fork, eat, and then release the lock on the left fork, release the lock on the right. This is essentially what you are trying to do. Okay, that's basically shown here. Instead of lock, we are just using semaphores here. So you say this is a binary semaphore. So we are going to say get a lock on the left semaphore, get a lock on the right semaphore, I and I plus 1, and then you eat. And this is what you continue doing. Okay, so once you're done eating, you release the lock, you go back to thinking, and then cycle back. Yes.
Each philosopher have a specific place that they have to eat?
Does each philosopher is sitting on the table. Okay, so you are given an ID. You are philosopher 3, then you can basically get fork number 3 and fork number 4. So you can't grab any arbitrary fork.
I'm just wondering, actually, can they grab any arbitrary plate?
Well, the plate is not material at all in this scenario. The idea is you are sitting at a location. So let's assume the plate is assigned to you, just to simplify the question, or simplify the question you are asking. Okay, so you already sit at a location I, seat I, and that basically says you need to get fork I and fork I plus 1. Okay, your left fork, and they are all numbered in this case, just to make it simple. Okay. Alright, so now we go back to this solution where I said The solution essentially says grab a lock on the left fork, grab a lock on the right fork, and then go back and have a good time eating, and then release the lock. The question is, will this work? If not, if okay, several people have suggestions. Yes, you have something to say. Okay. You had same things, if something else to say. Okay, yes.
Couldn't you just limit the number of people that grab chopsticks at one time? Does only, like, in this case, two people grab chopsticks?
Okay. So two suggestions, or two comments rather, two different sets of comments. First comment was, this is a problem if every philosopher gets hungry at more or less the same time and executes that code, everybody reaches there to their left fork, and they grab that fork, and then they try to go grab the right fork, and the right fork is now in use by the philosopher that's to the right of you. So you basically sit there waiting for that fork, and each philosopher is waiting for someone else to do something, which is release their corresponding right fork, left fork, and nothing happens in the system. You basically have a situation called a deadlock, something that we are going to formally define later today. Okay, then the second suggestion, so I hope that is clear, right? So if every philosopher executes this code, meaning your scheduler runs such that first philosopher executes this statement, and then you, the scheduler says, let me run another thread, and you then execute that statement, and so on. So every philosopher just executes this statement, and then the scheduler cycles back and has each thread execute the second statement. They just wait, because by that time the other fork is already in use. Okay, so that's the issue that can occur if you have this kind of solution. Okay, second suggestion was, can you not limit the number of philosophers? We say only at odd hours, only odd philosophers can eat, and at even hours, only even philosophers can eat. That will solve the problem, incidentally. Okay, so if you put constraints on how the philosophers can go about grabbing force, it obviously will simplify the solution, and it does solve the problem. It doesn't solve the general problem where we don't want that restriction. I mean, that's almost as good as saying, let only one philosopher get hungry at any time. If only one philosopher is hungry, clearly the fork will always be available that you would own, and you will not have any contention for resources. Yes.
I guess my first thought to solving the problem would be to just use another lock, and so that you have one lock for everyone, and so you can only start picking up chopsticks if you have that lock. So you get the lock, you pick up your two chopsticks, you release the lock, at which point someone else can get the lock and start picking stuff up.
Okay.
Sort of like how we solved the other problem, where you have a much shorter critical section to protect your longer.
Okay. So suggestion is have one lock and then try to grab both chopsticks, both forks, rather. Yes, you are saying.
What if you pick up your left chopstick, and then if your right chopstick is occupied, you release both and you sleep for I?
Okay.
And because everyone has a different I, you won't sleep for the same amount of time, so you won't be trying to grab it again at the same time someone else is trying to grab it again.
Okay, so a different solution here says let's use randomization. Okay, randomization basically says you grab a chopstick, if the other chopstick is in use, you put it back. Okay, and you wait for a random period of time. Okay, randomization essentially tries to make the philosophers be hungry at different points in time. Okay, so that's essentially what's going to happen. If you go and say the right chopstick is in use, I'm going to release my left chopstick and I'm going to try 15 minutes from now, and some other philosopher says I'm going to try 33 minutes from now, odds are that the philosophers will now start trying at different points in time, and you will actually not have contention. Okay, randomization is always good. You probabilistically can guarantee that you will not have deadlock. By probabilistic, we mean that the chances of getting deadlock are very small, infinitesimally small. The more you randomize, no guarantees that it will always work, but it will with high probability work. Okay, yes, you have something else.
Can chopsticks share locks?
Can chopsticks share locks? So I think that's the solution you propose. It said let's have just one lock that is shared. No, no.
I was thinking one sort of central lock.
One lock for the whole.
Can pick up
Yes.
Chopsticks. Get the lock on the individual chopsticks unless they have the central.
Yeah.
So you don't need the central lock to hold the chopsticks, but you need it to pick them off.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. You don't need a lock to eat. You just need a lock to get the fork. Yes. You are saying something
lock
about...
Lock by place setting. So each chopstick has a pair of locks associated with it.
Okay. What does the pair do? So right, this solution actually had a lock per chopstick, actually.
That's what I'm saying, that each chopstick has two locks.
Two locks, okay.
Okay.
Okay. What does it do? If the so long as the chopstick is occupied, the second lock doesn't help. Right? I mean, we are really worried about the resource rather than how many locks are protecting the resource. So if the char...
Well, the ice philosopher doesn't have a fork yet and tries to pick one up and then tries to acquire a lock that he shares with the ice philosopher.
Right.
If the ice philosopher has a fork, then the ice can't acquire a lock.
Okay. So the solution will actually involve a number of these ideas that people have actually put forward. And I will not, let's ignore all that code there. This is basically the where the solution is going to work. We will have there's a thinking part where nothing is happening. Then when it's time to, when you're hungry, you basically call this take fork function. Okay, then you eat and then you put the forks back. What does take fork function? The problem, the only insight you really need to have is if you try to grab locks one at a time, then you are contending with someone else, because if they also try to grab your neighboring fork, so this philosopher grabs that lock and that philosopher grabs that lock and then you try to do the other one, then you are in trouble because you may get into a deadlock. Okay? So the real solution is if you want to grab two resources, try to do it atomically. Either grab both or don't grab either one. Okay? That way you won't have one and you are waiting for the other. You basically succeeded in grabbing both at the same time. Or you basically say one is in use, so I'm not even going to try. Okay, so that's really where we want to go. Okay, so that's going to give us an outline for the solution. And basically then what do you do if the lock is in lock or not the lock, but if the fork is in use was not we won't completely randomize it, but the solution, but we are going to put the philosopher to sleep. Okay. Rather than sleeping for an arbitrary amount of time, as was mentioned, we will just sleep until the philosopher, your neighboring philosopher, is going to check, are you actually hungry? And if so, I will wake you up. You are sleeping for your fork. Okay? So and by sleep, I mean sleep in the condition variable sense or a waiting sense. Okay, that's essentially what the solution does here. Okay, so that's the take fork function. This is the put fork function. What is in there is not as important. The only important function is this. So these are actually protected by a lock here. Okay, so these functions are, think of them as being synchronized in Java. The whole function is executing atomically. What you're doing is within that you're doing the test function. The test function says go check if both forks are available. If both forks are available, grab them. Okay. And if either fork is in use, if one or both forks are in use, go to sleep. Okay, and then when the forks become available, somebody will wake you up and you can try to grab the forks at that time. That's all we are doing. Okay, so it's going to check if the philosopher is hungry, and then it's saying if the left fork and the right fork are available, which means that nobody is eating, neither of those neighbors are eating, they is assumed that they're available, then you grab them. Okay, you set your state to eat. If not, you are going to basically go and block, saying that at least one fork is in use. I am hungry but I cannot eat, so I am going to wait. And then when the philosopher, either my right neighbor or my left neighbor, puts down the fork, he explicitly checks, can I wake up my left neighbor if the left neighbor is hungry by calling the same test function? Can I wake the right neighbor if the right neighbor is hungry? So your neighbors will explicitly wake you up when they are done eating. Okay, simple solution. Atomically grab both rather than grabbing one and then ending up blocking on the other. Try to grab both at the same time. If neither one is, at least one is not available, go to sleep. What the neighbors do is they are nice to you. So when they put down the fork, they will check, are you hungry? And if you are waiting for a fork, I will wake you up. Okay, that's what you essentially do. Okay, you can rewrite this in using monitors in Java, fairly straightforward. You'll use condition variables to wait and notify. You'll need a condition variable per philosopher to explicitly wake up someone. Okay? So it does have a global lock, that is what was mentioned. So to do the check, as was exactly as was pointed out, rather than to eat, just to check whether the forks are available, you'll use a global lock. Okay, that's what was actually mentioned. If the lock is in use, you sleep. Okay? So this is not a randomized solution, it's somewhat more deterministic, but similar concept. Okay, so you sleep and you're trying at a later time. Okay, any questions on this? Okay, the objective of going through some of these synchronization problems was to illustrate the various types of synchronization problems you can encounter in practice, and also to make you think. I mean, it's one thing to say here is a lock, here is a semaphore, here is a monitor. If you don't know how to use it to solve some practical scenarios, then you are not getting what they are useful for. Okay? So although our discussion has been very abstract, I did want to close by showing you several real world scenarios of where some of these problems are actually used. Okay, so we have done three: producers, consumers, we did reader writers, and we did dining philosophers. Okay, so they are actually fairly common. If you do any form of synchronization, you will see that this kind of problems occur over and over again. Producers, consumer, if you have a multimedia player, a video player, okay, let's say you are doing YouTube or something, or Netflix for that matter, you actually have producers and consumers going on in there. Okay, so what happens is you have a network buffer, okay, and then there is a server somewhere that's streaming you, let's say the YouTube server is streaming you video data, which comes and it fills this buffer up, and then there is a player here that is actually consuming from this buffer and trying to display that audio video content. Okay, that's a single producer, single consumer scenario. Okay, so if this buffer fills up, then there is a signal that the video player sends back to the producer saying stop sending. Okay, buffer is filled up, not something similar is not getting consumed. Likewise, if the buffer gets empty, then you see a glitch. You will see something saying buffering or some such message will pop up in your flash player. Okay, so that's what is happening in the background there. Okay, design of web servers also use producers and consumers. What happens there is we may do something like that with the last assignment. Not that complicated, but something simpler. So if you have a web server, let's say it's an Apache server that is serving some web pages somewhere. The way it's internally built, it is multi-threaded, and the way the threads work is there's something called a master thread and there are several slave threads. Okay, the master thread is the one that's listening for new requests from browsers. Okay, so anyone can then open up a browser and send a request. That request comes to the master thread. Okay, the master thread actually puts it into a work queue saying here is a request that's come in and we need to process this request. So what happens is one of these slave threads, consumers, they actually go to the work queue and then take a request and start processing it. Okay, so there's a pool of slave threads that are sitting there trying to service requests. So you have this queue which is equivalent to a producer-consumer queue. Okay, as far as readers and writers are concerned, there are many examples there. Last time we were talking about this banking example where there may be multiple reader threads that are just reading balances or reading data from a database, whether it's a banking database, and there are writer threads that may be running an updating balance. Maybe you deposited or withdrew money from an ATM, or there's a process that runs that adds interest to your bank and so on. Okay, so that's readers and writers. Dining philosophers problems occur any time when there are cooperating resources that are trying to contend for a limited number, not cooperating resources, cooperating processes that are contending for a limited number of resources. Okay, so you can think of disks, tapes, backups, processes that run that are trying to send data to a server and so on. Okay. This type of problem also occurs if you are doing a travel reservation. let's say you basically try to book an airline ticket. You want to go from, let's say, New York to Los Angeles, but there's no direct flight, so you have to book two segments. Okay, so each of those segments is essentially a resource that you are contending for. Okay, so, or you may say I want to do a hotel, airline and a car rental, and I want it either, it's all or nothing. I want them all. I don't want to be in a scenario where I have one or the other. Okay, so you have to go grab locks on each of these and you have to make the booking. Okay, or in the airline case, each flight might have its own lock, flight for reservation for a particular flight. So you want to grab all of those and then try to book a ticket with multiple segments. Okay, so all of these kinds of problems are solved using this dining philosopher's notion. Okay, any questions on this? So we will end the discussion on monitors. Okay, so we are now done with three different constructs for synchronizations. We started with locks, we did semaphores, counting binary semaphores, we did monitors. Okay, we solved three different types of problems along the way: reader, writer, producer, consumer, dining philosophers. Okay, so now we are going to switch gears and start another chapter on this. Is going to be on deadlocks. Okay, we just got an introduction to deadlocks. I gave you an incorrect solution of dining philosophers that can result in deadlock. Okay, so we already know what deadlock means, so we will formalize that notion here and then try to go a little deeper, understand what deadlocks are and so on. Okay, so let's start with the definition. Here's another example. Okay, so very simply put, deadlock is a condition where two or more threads are holding some resources but are waiting on others to give up their resources. Okay, so it, more formally, they are waiting for an event that can only be generated by that. The event here is to grab a lock, for instance. Okay, so here's an example of two processes or two threads that might end up in a deadlock. Okay, so what this process, each process is simply trying to do is print a file. Okay, so this, let's say, is the print driver. Okay, so process one is trying to take a file from disk, read a file from disk and send it off to the printer. And process B does the same thing. And we'll assume that printer is a shared resource, then these disks or files are shared resources, so you must grab a lock, okay, in this case, before you can do this operation. So process A first tries to grab a lock on the printer and then the disk, and process B actually does it in the opposite order. Okay, so you can easily see that process A runs and grabs a lock on the printer, and the scheduler switches you to process B, and then process B runs and grabs a lock on the disk, and then you switch back here. Then the next statement here tries to grab a lock on the disk. The disk lock is already in use by process B, so process A blocks. Okay, so it holds a lock on the printer, it's waiting for a lock on the disk. And then process B runs, it already holds a lock on the disk, tries to get the printer lock, which process A holds. Okay, so now each process has a lock, it's waiting for another. Okay, so here basically this is a very simple example of dining philosophers, where you can think of each of this as a left fork or a right fork. You grabbed one, you're waiting for the other, and that process grabbed the other one, and you're waiting on one another. Okay, now if this condition occurs, these processes are going to wait forever. Okay, because each of them has been put to sleep, the OS doesn't know what's going on, it will just keep them in the wait queue. Eventually the user will say nothing is printing, reboot. Okay, so you'll just kill the process or some such thing, and then the processes will be terminated. Okay, so this is what basically might happen. Okay, so deadlocks, some more terminology here. Deadlocks will occur when threads compete for a finite number of resources simultaneously, and they hold some and they wait for others. Okay, we'll formalize that notion of waiting and what we call circular wait in a few slides. Okay, there are two ways to deal with this. Okay, so the first type of techniques are what we will call deadlock prevention. Okay, so what will happen here is, before you actually are given a lock, so suppose you say I want a lock on this object. Before you are given the lock, the system is going to do some extra check, saying, if I gave this lock to this process, could it cause some trouble? Could it potentially lead to a deadlock? And if the answer is yes, then you will not grant that lock. You will make the process sleep. So in deadlock prevention, you are going to actually check the request. Even if the lock is free, you may not give that lock because doing so might lead to a problem. Okay, it's very simply put, if you did this type of technique in this case, you will actually have a printer lock, and when process B runs and tries to grab a disk lock, you might deny that request. You might make it wait, saying if you do that, then we might end up in a deadlock. Okay, so you are putting some restrictions in this case. Even though the lock may be available, you may refuse to grant it for reasons of safety. Yes.
Where would they even put that code? Would that be in part of the threading library, or would that be part of the kernel? Or
okay. So where would you put the code? I can only answer that in the abstract, because typically the real solution that people have adopted is, let's not worry about deadlocks. Let the user deal with it. Okay, if they find something is wrong, they'll kill some process, they'll reboot the system, so we will not worry about it. So that's the short answer, but to come back to what you asked, where would you put it? Okay. Typically, if you want, the OS is dealing with the locks, if semaphores or locks are kernel level objects, you have to put it in the kernel. If they're library objects, then you have to put it in the library. Okay, so whoever is managing those resources, deciding whether the lock should be given or not, that's the entity that would have to do these checks.
I meant more of the prevention.
Yes, that's what I meant, but that's exactly what I've said. So the whoever is implementing deadlock prevention is the same entity that is actually dealing with lock management in this case. Yes, there are two questions.
Just as a note, there are developer utilities that you can run on your code, such as Valgrind,
yes,
that will detect deadlocks for you, or at least will attempt to.
Yes. You are right in that there are developer tools. I am saying at runtime, nobody does this. Okay. If you are trying to do debugging, there will be tools that allow you to figure out whether your code might actually have deadlocks and should you write the code in this way or make suggestions. Okay, that's absolutely right. Yes.
So sometimes databases use the kernel, and that would be a place where they actually do a little bit of prevention.
Yes. So I will show you a very simple method which will actually prevent deadlocks altogether. And database, as was pointed out, databases use similar methods, and it's not very fancy. It's very simple idea, but we'll come back to that. So if you write code in a proper way, you will not have deadlocks to begin with. Okay, and just to give you a hint of what that means, if you actually flip the order of these statements, okay, so that both process A and process B actually first contend for the printer and the disk. So here you did it in the opposite way, you would not have this deadlock condition, because if process A got the printer lock and you switch to process B and you first ask for the printer lock, you would block then and there, you wouldn't grab anything else. Okay? What that means is, if there's a way by which you can order resources and get content for resources in order rather than in arbitrary order, you can avoid deadlock. But we'll come back to that and I'll show you how to do that. Okay? But as far as OSs are concerned, they don't implement this at runtime. You can, of course, check your code using tools to see if you wrote bad code. As was pointed out, databases do a lot of locking internally. So clearly, if you are a MySQL or Oracle developer, you don't want to ship code which has a deadlock in your customer's complaint. So they actually implement some form of internal deadlock detection. The database programmer never sees it. It's inside the database. Okay. That's deadlock prevention. The other kind of technique is what is called deadlock detection. Okay, what happens in deadlock detection is, the system after the fact figures out something is wrong and tries to take corrective action. Okay. So you detect instances of deadlock after they've occurred, and then you say, now there is a deadlock, something has to be done. Maybe you terminate a thread, or it's something equivalent to what the user would do. Kill the application. Well, you don't reboot the system in this case, but you could terminate all the threads that are waiting on these resources and free them all up. Okay. Either case, there have to be some restrictions or harsh measures taken to avoid deadlocks or to prevent them altogether. Okay. The only other point I'll make is to distinguish between deadlocks and starvation. Okay. Starvation is a condition where some threads are making progress, but others are not getting a resource. Okay, but there is overall progress in the system. Okay. Deadlock is a condition where no one is making progress. Everyone is waiting. Okay, so keep in mind that there's a difference between starvation and deadlock. In starvation, some threads are making progress. In the shortest job first, the shortest jobs were getting scheduled, the long job was getting started, but somebody was at least happy. Okay, in deadlocks, everyone is blocked. There is no progress in the system. So this is the difference to keep in mind. So they are different in that sense. Okay. So I am going to mention four conditions that are necessary for a deadlock. Okay. So these are what are called necessary conditions. I hope you know what necessary and sufficient conditions are by now. Right. So what necessary condition means is if you know that there is a deadlock in the system, all these conditions are true. Okay, that all of those conditions actually hold. Okay. I will also mention that these are not sufficient conditions for a deadlock, which means I will show you examples where even if all of these conditions are true, there may not be a deadlock. Sometimes there may be, but it doesn't mean that it guarantees a deadlock. In other words, it's basically A implies B. So if there is a deadlock, that implies that all those four conditions are true. But if those four, B does not imply A, okay, just because A implies B, that's something to keep in mind. Okay, but let's look at the condition. What does it mean? So let's assume that a deadlock has occurred. Then it's guaranteed that there is some mutual exclusion in the system, okay, meaning that there are locks and some processes are contending for locks. Without that, clearly there couldn't have been a deadlock. Okay, the whole reason we got into a deadlock is there was some mutual exclusion. Okay. And second condition is saying that there is hold and wait. Okay, what that means is, since there is a deadlock, we also now know that some threads are holding some resources and waiting for other resources. Okay. Some philosophers may be holding their left fork and are waiting for the right fork. That's called hold and wait. You hold some and you wait for others. That there is no preemption in the system, which means you can't forcibly take a lock from someone. Okay, if you could do that, then of course the problem would be solved. If in dining philosophy you could just grab the fork from the other, your neighbor, and start eating, then you wouldn't have a deadlock, but we don't allow that in the system. Okay. And there is circular wait. Okay, there is hold and wait, but there is a circular loop. Okay, which A means, it means that A is waiting on a resource from B, B is waiting on a resource from C, and C is waiting on a resource held by A. If you have this circular loop, then you basically cannot resolve that. Okay, that's why you are basically all waiting on one another and nobody is able to give up a resource. Okay, and you are all stuck. Okay, so this is like four cars arrive at the stop sign all at once and everybody is waiting for someone else to go. Okay, so you each assume that somebody else will go and you are all stuck. Okay, that's a good example of a deadlock as well. Okay. So those are the four conditions. We'll mostly focus on circular wait because that's really the crux of it. Okay, the reason you have a deadlock is you have this condition where each thread is holding a resource and waiting for another thread to release a resource, and then you do this in a cycle. As soon as you are cycle, you are in trouble because there is nobody can give up a resource and make progress. Okay? If there was no cycle, you could argue that you will eventually not have this problem, because if A is waiting on B and B is waiting on C, but C is not waiting on anything, then eventually C will finish whatever critical section it was. It will release its resources. Let's say a lock that will go to A, B rather, B will do whatever it wants to do. Now it has all the resources. It will, once it's done, it will release its locks and A can make progress. Okay, so if there's no cycle, there's a way by which you can resolve this wait conditions. And eventually somebody will give up the resource that someone else is waiting. So if there's a cycle, you're in trouble. Okay? So as far as how to first detect deadlock is concerned, the way you would do this is you would track what entities are making requests and what resources are they making requests on. Okay, this is represented in the abstract using what is called a resource allocation graph. Okay, here is an example of a resource allocation graph. It's very simple. Okay, here circles represent threads, the squares represent resources. Okay, what they are, we don't actually care, but you could say in dining philosopher, the circles would represent philosophers, each square would be a fork. Okay? And we have edges going from circles to squares or vice versa. And depending, and these are directed edges as you can see, and depending on whether the edge goes from a thread to a resource or a resource to a thread, it means different things. if you have a thread going from a not a thread, if you have an arrow going from a thread to a resource, that means this thread wants that resource. Okay, it's called a request edge. This thread has requested this lock or this fork. Okay. If you have an arrow going in the other way, that says that this resource is currently held by that thread. Okay. It's basically this lock is currently held by that thread. Okay. That's called an assignment edge. The resources are assigned to that thread. So you can have a request edge in your resource allocation graph, or you can have an assignment edge. Okay. When you do a lock acquire, internally, if your system is trying to do this kind of stuff, it will actually create an edge saying you just requested a resource, okay, before, and then it will say, should I grant that resource or not? Okay? So basically what this says, if you have such a graph, and if you have, so there are two statements we can make here. If there are no cycles in the graph, we are guaranteed that no deadlock exists. If there is no cycle, that means there is no circular wait or no hold and wait, then there is no deadlock at all. Okay? But if there is a cycle, then a deadlock might exist. It's not a guarantee that it will be there, because as I said, these are necessary but not sufficient condition. But cycles are dangerous. Okay? They don't guarantee a deadlock, but they might lead to a deadlock. So we want to avoid them. Yes?
Is there a situation where you want a cycle in your code?
Is there a situation where you want? Typically, no, you do not want that situation to occur. Okay, you want to avoid that as far as possible, so because that might lead to a deadlock. It doesn't mean there is a deadlock, but it could potentially lead to one. That's what it means. Okay, so what does your, so this should give you a sense of what should the deadlock detection algorithm do, or deadlock prevention algorithm do. If you want a deadlock prevention algorithm, every time a lock acquire request comes in, you put in an edge and say, if I put this edge, will this actually result in a cycle? If there's a cycle, it's I don't like cycles, so I'm not going to grant that lock. Okay? A deadlock detection algorithm, on the other hand, what it has to do is periodically it will scan this graph. Say, is there a cycle? Okay, if you have done any 311 like course, you must know that there are cycle detection algorithms for graphs. Okay, you can basically write this as a graph, you can say edges and say, is there a cycle? You just run a standard cycle detector on this graph and you see if there are cycles. And if there's a cycle, you say that's bad, I'm going to either terminate this thread and kill this edge. If you terminate a thread, it will release the resources or do something about it. Okay, so that's going to do deadlock avoidance. Now here is an example to show you why even if there is a cycle, you may not actually have a deadlock. Okay? And this only occurs if there are multiple instances of a resource. Okay? In this previous case, there was one box for resource R1 and one box for resource R2. So that means that there was only one instance of that resource. If there are multiple instances of the resource and you don't care which instance you actually use, then you might still have a cycle, but there won't be a problem. And what does multiple instances mean? Let's say it's a bank of printers. You just want to print. Let's say you are in the EdLab. I don't know if the EdLab even has a printer. But assume that there is a bank of printers in the EdLab. You want to just print your source code. You just say print. One of those printers will print. You don't care which one. They are roughly equivalent from your perspective. Okay. So there may be scenarios where you want a resource, say a printer or some such thing. But you don't actually care which one. They are equivalent from your perspective. So you just say, give me an instance of a printer and print this job. Or give me some, or process this job on one of these machines. I don't care which one, because they will all do the trick for me. Okay? That is what is shown here. So now you see that there are two instances of R3, three instances of R4, and one of each of these. Okay? So now what might happen is, if you have a cycle, this is still not indicative. So here is an example sort of to show you why there may be a cycle, but still threads can make progress. Okay, so you will see, if you actually run through this, there is a cycle here from R3 to T2 to R1 to T3 to R2 T4 and so on. Okay, that's a cycle in this graph. Okay, but we can show that you can still have progress because there are three instances of R3. Okay, currently one instance is given to T1. Let's say T1 eventually finishes its critical section, it's going to release that instance. So this instance becomes free. Okay. Once this instance becomes free, you have a case where T4 has requested an instance of. So you will actually say, here a printer has become free, you want to print a job, take this printer. Okay, so then basically this edge, which is a request edge, becomes an assignment edge. So you get that resource and then your cycle is broken immediately. Okay, because now T4 can finish. If once T4 finishes, it will release R2, when R2 is given to T3, T3 will finish, it will release R1, that will go back to R2 and the cycle is gone.
The left graph, is that a deadlock or no?
It's a left graph, a deadlock, so you'll see that there is a cycle here. Okay. But in this case, you will actually, and there are actually as a matter of two cycles, so in this case, you will have a deadlock. Okay. This is just to show that if there is a cycle, some cases you might have a deadlock and some cases you won't. Okay. So the only thing I will say is if there's only one instance of each resource, as in this case, and there is a cycle, that's a guaranteed deadlock. Because there is no way to break this cycle. There's no way to say you go first and do it and then you release that resource and somebody else makes progress. But when there are multiple instances of a resource, then you might still have cycles like in this case, but all threads can eventually get the resources they have requested and the cycle is broken in that case. Okay, and this is why having a cycle is not a sufficient condition for a deadlock. Just because there is a cycle, you can't say that's a deadlock, that's a bad case, so I'm going to have to do something about it. That may not be the case. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so now you can say I can detect a deadlock by looking for cycles, which is a potential deadlock, and then correct it, which correction is usually harsh method. You either kill all the cycles, kill all the threads in the cycle, kill the threads one at a time, grab the resources back, and so on. Okay? Typically, this is the reason why operating systems don't go and do anything like this. Okay? You don't want system, the OS, to arbitrarily start killing threads in your code or your processes. If your process was well behaved, all it did was acquire a lock system, basically says I'm going to terminate you. That doesn't sound right. Okay, so this is why typically deadlock detection is left to the programmer or a library, saying I won't do anything, you deal with it. Okay, whatever you want to do, you can check for resource loops and whatnot. That could be either the library or the programmer, or in the case of databases, the database person who wrote the database. OS doesn't do it, okay? Because to do it you have to take harsh measures, and OS cannot say which thread to terminate or whose application to terminate. Okay, it can't figure out which this is more important than that and what's the right thing. Typically the user knows better, okay? So you leave the problem to the user. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing I wanted to mention is, although you can detect cycles and do something like that, that is an expensive operation. Okay? Cycle detectors are order n square time algorithms. Okay? If you have n nodes in your graph, to detect whether there is a cycle, the algorithm say order n square. Okay? It's sort of quadratic in the number of nodes in the graph. If you have lots of hundreds of processes and thousands of resources, you are talking about an algorithm that may actually take quite a bit of time to even figure out if there is a cycle in your graph. Okay? Because you are running order n square algorithm. Okay, so you don't want to do this frequently when there are lots of resources, and you might use other ways to figure out whether to do it at all. So for instance, if your CPU utilization on your system drops, there are lots of processes but the utilization is at zero. Okay, maybe you should run a cycle detector and say, is there a deadlock, is everyone waiting for someone else and nothing is happening in the system. So you can use these kinds of heuristics to run these expensive cycle detectors, okay, rather than saying run it once a minute and check whether there's a deadlock. Okay, that might not be the right approach, okay, if at all. So as I said, you actually don't do it. As I said, current programmers don't, and OSs don't worry about it at all. They leave it to the programmer, saying it's not my problem, you deal with it. Okay, but if you are a programmer and you're writing code, you either write it such that there is no deadlock at all, you're guaranteed not to have one, or you might have to do something like this. Okay, so now let's ask the questions. OS is not going to help you, you are the programmer and you have to write code that is not going to actually result in a deadlock. What would you do? Okay. You will use techniques in your code that do some form of deadlock prevention. Okay. Deadlock prevention says I do something so I'm guaranteed not to have a deadlock at all. Okay. So question is how will you write code so you are guaranteed not to have a deadlock. Yes.
Remove one of those possibilities.
Yes. So I said these are necessary conditions for a deadlock. If one of those if you write code such as one of those conditions is always false, then you can never have a deadlock. Okay? Because if a deadlock occurs, all these conditions are true. But if one of these is always false, you cannot have a deadlock. Because then if the deadlock happened, that condition would have to be true. So if you wrote your code such that one of those things don't happen in your program, you are guaranteed. And this is very simple to understand why it's guaranteed. Let's take the first one, mutual exclusion. Okay, make it false in your code. That means that you write code with no locks, no synchronization. Okay, no deadlock. There's nothing to contend for. Maybe your code won't work. There will be all sorts of race conditions, but deadlock is gone. No, that is not the solution you should adopt. But I'm just making a point saying, yes, you can put some restrictions on your code and say that I'm guaranteed there's no deadlock. One way is you don't use any synchronization at all. Okay, then there's no mutual exclusion. Yeah, you don't want to do that, obviously. You want synchronization. So mutual exclusion, if you have multi-threaded code, can't be false. Okay, so you will have that by just to protect shared variables. So one of these three things can be made false. One is you can make the no preemption case false, which says, if I grab a lock, then I can force it away from you and give it to someone else. Okay, if you have to use the sync library that did that, then it's very hard to write code because you don't know what lock means. I have a lock, I'm in the middle of a critical section, library comes along, too bad, I'm taking it away from you. So that was also not going to work. Okay, so you could write a library that preempts, okay, which you don't want either. So basically you have one of these two that are more practical. You can either not have hold and wait. Okay. Hold, if you don't have hold and wait, that means if you hold a lock, I can never go to sleep on something. Because that would be hold and wait. So if you basically you either don't do that or you don't do this. You cannot have circular wait. Okay. The simplest heuristic is to actually avoid this, not have circular wait in your code. Okay, I'll give you an example of how to avoid. So all these other three are, you can of course impose some restrictions to make one of those false, but they're not very practical restrictions. This one is actually doable. Okay, so most of the code that you actually see, well-written code, has implicitly assumed that there will be no circular wait and that's guaranteed in your code. Okay, and I'll show you a way to do that. So if you have let's say you have some resources, so KN resources you want to protect. The simplest way to avoid circular wait is to, when you write code, is to implicitly order these resources. So we'll just call them R1, R2. So whatever these resources are, you just assign them an ID and you order them. So this is resource number 1, this is resource number 2, resource number 3, 4, and so on. And if you want to now grab locks on multiple resources, you always have to acquire locks in ascending order. You basically say, if I want locks on, let's say, R2, R4, and R6, I always have to do it in that order. I will go with the lowest number resource, grab that lock, then this lock, and this lock. Okay, yes, question. Yes, so either you would have to write code such that you have grabbed that, you anticipated the need for that other lock first and grabbed it, or you release it and then try to acquire both locks in that order. Okay, that's the only way to do it. Okay. So now I suggested a rule. Okay, it's a simple rule of thumb. Rule of thumb says you have some number of locks, give them some IDs, order them 1 through N, and in your code always ensure that you always acquire locks in increasing order of ID. It doesn't mean you have to get them all, but if you need two of them, you get them in order. Okay? And the claim is if you do that, circular wait is avoided. Why is that? Yes.
Because you have to get some first lot before you get any other lot. So you prevent that condition that you have in the previous slide of you get somebody gets A before B and somebody gets B before A. So it happens to be more.
Yes. So this is, you can reason it this way, you can say prove by contradiction. You say, I followed your rule of thumb, but I still got a circular weight. And you can prove that that's incorrect. Because if you have circular weight, you will basically have a scenario where you have a cycle like this. If you have a cycle like this, that means that some thread is actually holding a lock on N and asking for a lock on a lowered ID resource. Okay, because that's the only way you can hold a lock and then have a cycle going back. Okay. And if you actually followed the rule, you always acquired a lock in increasing order, you can never have that condition. Like, I already hold a lock on R10, I'm asking for a lock on R3. That shouldn't have happened. You should have gotten that lock first before you even gotten that. Okay, that's just a proof by contradiction. It's the same scenario that was mentioned there in the very first example that I said if you flip the order, so basically you are implicitly ordering, saying printer is resource 1, disk is resource 2. The reason we had this is this process actually violated that rule. Okay, try to grab a lock on 2 and then 1 and you had a deadlock. If you just simply flip this, okay, and you always first ask for the printer then the disk, you will never have a deadlock, that's guaranteed. Okay, because here you implicitly ordered it. Okay, so simple way to write code is if you have multiple locks resources, you when you have a sheet of paper or whatever and document the order in which you want to, whatever that order, the order doesn't matter. Okay, you can pick the order. Okay, but you document the order and always ensure that your code is actually acquiring locks in order. If you start acquiring locks in random order, you might end up with a cycle and that will have a deadlock. Okay. So simple rule when you write any multi-threaded code to avoid deadlock is you do deadlock prevention and explicitly you are making this condition false. Okay, you impose an ordering on resources and request them in order. Okay? Any questions here? Okay, so this is how you will actually work. Your OS won't do anything for you. You are supposed to write code, and if you know any multi-programmer using multi-threaded code, this is what they will implicitly do, okay, to avoid any problems. Okay, so we have some time. I'm just going to present, if there are no questions, this algorithm called Banker's algorithm, another of those Dijkstra's contributions. And I'm going to stop there. We won't go into all the gory details today. We can come back to it. Okay, so what Banker's algorithm does, this was designed for either a library or the OS to actually implement. And this is also doing deadlock prevention. Okay, it is actually implementing this for... Okay, so it is actually trying to avoid circular weights. In some sense, okay, it's an algorithm that formally, it's a general algorithm that tries to avoid circular weight internally. And here, you don't assume that the programmer has actually done any ordering of this sort. Okay, the programmer is asking for resources in arbitrary order. Okay, and so that can actually lead to a cycle. So internally, you check, will there be a problem? Okay, and then you will only allow for requests to go through if you are guaranteed that there won't be a circular weight. Okay, so that's basically what the algorithm tries to do, and I'm going to illustrate that with a simple scenario. We have threads T1, T2 and T3, okay, and they're contending for one of 12 tape drives. Okay, tape drives are backup devices, okay, not used very commonly today, but what you basically use, you have this bank of tape drives, a backup process runs, so these threads are typically backup processes. Your backup process in the machine, you will take all the files that have been modified, you send it to a tape drive saying go back this up. Okay, and the tape drive will actually put it on archival storage. Okay, so these threads are essentially contending for these tape drives, and then the assumption is as the backup process runs, they may actually ask for more tape drives to send more data or release those tape drives and so on. Okay. So each thread basically declares how maximum number of resources it might request over the course of its execution. Okay, so this thread says it may need at most 4 tape drives to back up all the data it is trying to send. Okay, this tape drives thread says it needs 8. This thread T3 says it may need all 12. It has a lot of data to back up. Okay, so this is what you declare at the beginning for the job runs. Okay, this is the current snapshot of what has actually happened in the system. So at this point in time, this thread holds 3 of these tape drives, this holds 4, this holds 4. Okay, so 11 of the dozen tape drives are currently in use. Okay, there is one tape drive that is currently free. Okay, and then basically what that means is if this says I need a max of 4, I am currently using 3, I can request, I am allowed to request one more, okay, based on what I declared. This one has said it could need 8, currently has 4 allocated to it, it can request for 4 more. And then this one can request for 8 more. Okay. So the question is now, in the worst case, all of these 3 threads can come and say, I want the remaining ones that I said I would request. Okay, thread T1 says, I want that one more that I said I would request. T2 says, I want 4. And T3 says, I want 8. Okay, the question is, can we reason about this scenario and say, is that if they come back and say, this is what I want, should we let them proceed and give them whatever they were requested in some order, or can that lead to a deadlock? Because there, so this is a case where you are holding some tape drives and you are asking for some more. Okay, so you have a hold, you might have a hold and wait. Can that result in a deadlock? Okay, that's the question we are trying to ask.
Yes.
Okay, you're saying yes.
If you do we consider these an actual pool in the sense that they are round robin?
We can schedule them in any order. So the assumption is, this is what you said you might ask for, this is what you currently hold, and in the worst case, all the threads came and said, hey, I want the max that I said I would request. What should the system do? Should it say, I'm going to let you guys ask for the max, or say that that's going to be unsafe in some way? Yes, question.
So comment. I think, like it says, with the current state of the system, if T1 asks for the remaining drive, then we're fine, because T1 couldn't possibly end up waiting on anything else, so we've gotten everything it could want, yeah. And then it will eventually finish. But if T2 asks for the remaining drive at this point, which it might do, because it could ask for up to 4 more drives, we shouldn't give it to it, because if T2 asks for the drive, then we have no drives left, at which point T1 might decide it needs a 4th drive, ask for it, wait because it doesn't get it. Meanwhile, T2 is waiting, decides it needs another drive and waits, but there are no drives left, so they both end up waiting, and
right.
Neither one ever releases any drives.
So let's take a simple case. Let's say T1, not all 3, but T1 comes and says, I want that one more drive that I said I would request. Okay. So question is, should we give that drive to it? And the answer is, you should give that drive if there is a way by which that request will finish and everybody else can also finish. Okay, so here is a scenario. So there is one drive available. 11 are in use, there is one available. Let's say T1 asks for that one. So you give it that drive. So now it has 4. It has 4 and it said it would ask for 4. So it can actually execute and eventually finish. Okay. Once it finishes, it will release the 4 it is holding back to the pool. So now there are only 8, because these 2 have 8 and there are 4 more remaining. And then if T2 wants its max allocation, you can actually give it the 4 that T1 has just released. So it can max, go to its max capacity, use whatever, finish its task and release all the 8 that it is holding. And then you can give that to T3, which will can take its max and finish. So the claim, and we'll not go beyond that today, the claim is if T1 makes a request, it is okay for the system to give it, because there is at least one order in which all the threads can get their maximum allocation and safely finish. You won't have a case where there aren't enough resources to go by and everybody is waiting for someone else to finish. If everyone is waiting for someone else to finish first, you have a deadlock. Here, there is a way by which each of them can take turns, finish, release their resources, let someone else make progress. So you won't have a case where you are waiting on someone else and there's circular wait. Okay? For this particular request. Okay? So what the system would do is, if T1 came in and said, I want one more drive, it will do this analysis. Whatever I said intuitively, this is an algorithm we'll look at next time. It will actually do this analysis and say, is this okay? Should I give this tape? Should I grant this request? Okay, and in this case, it will come back with an answer saying it is okay because you won't have hold and wait and circular wait. So let's go ahead and give that. Okay? And we'll next time we'll show an example where it's not okay. Okay, if you had granted that request, then if some other thread comes along, you are basically in trouble because it's going to be a situation where there's a circular wait. Okay. So the banker's algorithm, the intuition for me and banker's algorithm, whenever a request comes in, it goes and checks, is this a safe request to grant or is this, or will that be put the system in a safe state or an unsafe state? If you're in an unsafe state, that says you can actually have a deadlock. You don't want to go there. If you're in a safe state, that says it doesn't matter if you grant this request because all other requests can come in and you can still finish in some order. Okay, so next time we will actually go and look at this banker's algorithm to do essentially that. Okay, so how do you codify that in an algorithm and how do you decide when are you in safe state and when are you not in safe state. Okay, so I am going to finish the lecture here.